Good morning, everybody. I'm a recovering addict called Tanya. Grateful to be here. It's good to be alive today. I'd like to thank the Chesapeake Potomac area for inviting me and running the risk and taking a chance on me this morning. For that, I'm truly grateful. I just want you guys to know that I really have been struggling this weekend because I didn't know what I was supposed to do. If anybody knows me, I spend a lot of time sitting around, listening, waiting to see what God wants me to do. So I'll be just sitting around, listening, trying to figure out what I'm supposed to be doing. It never came to me. I started getting scared because I was like, I don't have no jump off drama. I don't have any crisis right now. What am I going to say to them? So I went to the Sunrise Morning Meeting. And when I got close to the water, y'all got to bear with me. When I got to the beach, I was like, phew. I opened right up. Me and water have this real relationship. I want to thank Martin C. for going to the 12th step in the It Works How and Why. He simply said that the best assurance to carrying the message is just being yourself. He said he hopes somebody, if it's just one somebody, got that. Thank you, Martin, because I did. I got a process to share about a person that, you know, the 12 steps, some things happen to you prior to coming into the program of Narcotics Anonymous. Before you get to honesty, before you get to open-mindedness, before you get to willingness, there's a couple of things that need to happen to you, and one of them is hope. I came to the fellowship in September of 1990, the 28th to be exact, 29th of 1990. On a 12-step call. She had talked to me all night. She said that I never had to use again. And I was like, for real? She was like, can you make this meeting? I'll be looking for you. I was like, I'll be there. And I went to the meeting. She was cheering. And she was talking about her experience with the 12-step call. And she said that she hopes that the person is here at this meeting today, and I was. I made 7 meetings, and on the 7th day, I said, my name is Tanya, and I'm an addict. And I hurry up, and I ran to the phone, and I called her. And I said, can you be my sponsor? And she was like, she said, no, you'll find somebody. As you know, that's what I heard. I heard I had to hurry up and get a sponsor. So I called her and I asked her. And she said, no, you go ahead. You'll find somebody. that want to help you in your recovery and who believes in you. You'll be fine. And I was like, well, you know, you're the first person I connected with, and this is what they say has to happen. She said, no, no, well, you go here, baby. You go here. You'll be fine. I never seen her again. I never heard from her again. And I've been here for 15 years. And I want to thank that 12-step calling member for that life-saving call she gave me that night. She talked to me all night. All night. And for that, I'm truly grateful. I came into this program being my own God. Never really caring about nobody but myself. Didn't have the capacity to trust anything other than me. And if you come in here and you knew and you got that, I guarantee you, you'll have a rough road. I came to this program married, two small children, and a desire never to get high again. At the time, my husband had went to treatment, and I said, I'm so glad that he went because he is really our problem, and we're not going to get better or anything until he can get some help for himself. Never mind that I was smoking just as much coke as he was at the table with our son, 1 year old, underneath of the table playing. So he went to treatment on the 19th, and his clean date is September the 20th, which is my birthday, and it was my clean date too, but I had another idea, and I used again. I went and got his last paycheck from the job and cashed it, of course, and smoked 20 at a time all night, and we'll get to that later. All night I smoked his money while he was in treatment. They told him, don't dial for pain and call home. And he said, if I use, he gonna leave me or something like that. That was after I had to tell him the truth about spending all his money. I came home after the last 20 was gone, and I looked at my children, because I understand that. Whatever it takes for you to get here, whatever your because is, use it until you find why you really need to stay here. And my children were my because. I need to get clean because I can't be the mom that I need to be for them. How I'm going to make bottles, you know, boil the formula, sterilize the bottles and do all this, and smoke coke. It wasn't going to go together. That was my awakening. I hadn't even gotten to the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. That was my moment of clarity. That was my moment of sanity. That was my cry for help. I watched my children sleep. And I couldn't do it anymore. Of course, I had to explain what happened to the money and, you know, all of that. And I called the lady because I figured she could help me with this dilemma. And she did. And she sent me to a meeting. And I've been coming back ever since. I understand the day that it was because of that, that I am where I'm at today. Even though my whole entire life changed as a direct result of that. I didn't want to get high anymore, but I did not count on all the changes that was going to be happening to me once I turned my will and my life over to the care of God. I didn't know that everything that I had come to trust and believe in was going to be taken away from me, and that I was going to have to find some reason to stay clean for myself. I began to get vested into the fellowship. I had a home group. I got a sponsor. I found somebody in 90 days. Her and her husband was married. It seemed like a good idea. She helped me build a foundation. Without her, I would not have survived all of the many storms that I encountered because I was building a relationship with God. I want to thank my first sponsor, because she truly helped me set the stage for what was to become, you know, what was going to happen to me in my life. I had this secret, right? I ain't never tell nobody my whole life. I was too ashamed and embarrassed, and I really didn't want to tell the truth. So I began to let my mother live vicariously through me. You know, she wanted to go away to college. She wanted to have the big wedding. I did all of those things. But I'm not quite sure if it was really what I wanted to do. So I got married, you know, started smoking coke. Got married, then started smoking coke. Then had kids. Smoked coke, had kids. Smoked coke with being pregnant with kids. Didn't really care. Couldn't care. Couldn't stop. Came into the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous with my husband. And then once I got here, I started to discover why I had been running from me my whole entire life. And I had to try to get the courage to do something about my dilemma. Narcotics Anonymous is a fellowship that, regardless of age, race, sexual identity, creed, religion, lack of religion, what you have done in the past, how much, how little. The only thing we care about is what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. My friend who died a few years ago, I called her. I had 8 months clean. I called her to the park. I said, I got to tell you something. Something's going on with me. I got to tell you the truth. And she rushed to the park. She was like, what is it? What is it? And I said, I'm gay. She said, what? I said, I'm gay. I have been gay my whole life. Not by resentment, just like really gay. Like, just really gay and ashamed and embarrassed. She said, well, what you gonna do? You got this husband and these kids and everything. And I said, I don't know, but I can't get high anymore. So because I lacked the necessary courage at 8 months clean to do what I needed to do for myself, it took the next 3 years and a whole bunch of it's going to beat you home first stuff for me to tell my husband the truth. And really at that point, he wanted to kill me. And it seems as if the area had divided itself and wasn't nobody trying to be my friend. Some people are here to remember that. I had never thought about getting high. Never, not one time. And I kept coming to meetings every single day. Every day. And I raised my hand every day. And people would laugh. Of course, they're not here to see this, right? But they would laugh and they wouldn't let their girlfriends hang around me and stuff, you know, stuff like that. I was feeling a little sexually insecure, I guess, in their own lives. So, you know, they didn't, you know, want me to be with their women. And, you know, it just really, you know, my husband was in the room falling all apart. And everybody was like, how could you do this? My first sponsor stopped sponsoring me because of it. She was like, this is really like some type of defect of character, sweetie. You really need to pull yourself together. And I remained sponsorless for like 6 months. And nobody would talk to me. I mean, this was really like a horrible thing. And I did not think about getting high. And I kept coming to meetings every day. And I kept raising my hand. Because regardless of who I need to be in here, I'm still welcomed. I still got to recover. I I still got to get the freedom that y'all say we get to get. I still am entitled to that, being here. And my sexual preference shouldn't make a difference because I still suffer hurt, ache. That broken spot in me is still the same. It's still the same. The lack of God in my life, the fear of trusting others is still the same. It says regardless, we all have a shot to acquire the freedom that this program offers. And I want mine, basically. So, you know, nobody never talked to me. And I understand that that was really a time that God was coming into my life, but I didn't know that. We cool with that. It's good. And I am free to be me. I just am. You know, like, we, you know, it's not even really like that anymore. But I had to come from a place of no acceptance to getting some acceptance or finding somebody that had acceptance about themselves so they could teach me how to accept me. And that's how that happened. I ain't had none, but I found somebody who had some. And then they helped me get some. And now I got some. The process of recovery costs to give, but the gifts of receiving are tremendous. And I walked away from everything I had at 3 years clean to get on this search of finding out who I really was. And yeah, it's been some time that I really didn't know if this is what God wanted me to do. So I would kind of pray about it and not tell him the whole story, so to speak. I would pray half prayers, thinking that he wouldn't know if I didn't say it on my knees. But we got past that too, and we're still okay. My involvement in this process has been time-staking. It's been a slow, nurturing, coming to maturity level, and I'm okay today. But I didn't take you from the beginning. So I started to go to other areas, find other women, found a new sponsor. I didn't want to be a mom no more. I was like, look, come and get them. And I meant that. I have two sons. One is 17 and one is 15. At the time, it was like 6 and 8. And I didn't want to be their mom no more because I felt like all of this has interrupted my life. And I'm too busy and I have things to do and all of this that I didn't get to do. After all, I wanted to be an attorney and I came home from college and I married you. And look at where we're at. This is when I only knew half the truth. I'm just telling y'all about the process. It is the little things that always tied me to y'all that have me being the woman that I am today. But at that time, I couldn't see that. So it's okay. Because some things you need to wake up to or come to in, they just kind of dawn on you. So I left. And he took the boys. And I started to carry on like people that ain't in touch with who they really are do. And I hurt a lot of people. And I didn't really care. Because self-destruction was the key back then. It wasn't surrender. It was about do what you do, take plenty of prisoners, create a whole bunch of drama, stay on the front street in the meetings. Please, you need this type of publicity. You know, create all of this havoc, mess with other people's wives, and all of that. God was like, yeah, yeah, all right. Come on, come on. I sit a lot of nights by myself trying to figure out where I went wrong and why would I think that giving my children away would be the thing that I didn't need in my life after a second step. I was empty and I wanted to fill it with all the wrong things. I really did pass over the second step with a minimum of concern. If anybody thinks that they don't, when you stop getting high and you start to feel that which is not full anymore from drugs, I don't think that they're always going to be the right thing at first. I didn't know no better. And God had shown me favor for my level of ignorance at that stage of recovery. And I'm really grateful for that, because I surely became accountable very quickly in the step process. And it was no more cuts. You know, it wasn't no more shortcuts. And I became straight accountable after I made a decision to turn my will and my life over, and I started getting to the exact natures of my wrong. I started to take some ownership and some responsibility in what was broke about me. See, I had been broken way before I used, and I've always been a very codependent person. I really, really have. And it still is the very sickest part of me today. I went from having about 15, 20, 20, 20-something sponsees, because I was so sick and broke that I felt like I needed to validate myself through helping them or fixing them, so I thought, to just having the group of girls that I have today. And I had to learn that the hard way. See, I always want to go retrieve you even after you've hurt me and use spiritual principles and say that that's okay, and not really protect myself in any kind of way. And I don't live like that today. Today I take pride in who is going to be around me and where my spirit connects at, and it's vital, it's important to me. But back then I really didn't care. It was just like, take it all, leave none, don't care about nobody, and just do what you do. Because you bad like that anyway. I still was the God in my life at that time. And even though I had to start seeing the evidence that God could really help you through other people first. See, everything that I've learned in here, I've learned by watching y'all. I understand that it is the gifts that I've gotten from watching y'all that have helped me build and put my life together. I had none of these things. I wasn't in touch with God. And after a while, I was all lonely and stuff. Of course, I chased a dream. Let me just say that. And it looked so rosy on the other side that once I had given all of those things away, I was by myself. I truly believe that that's what God wanted me to be, so that he could work with my heart. My heart needed to change. The condition of my heart needed to change. And in order for him to do that, he had to put me in the right posture so people stopped calling me. Nothing wasn't moving. Y'all know that. No one ain't nothing moving. And it's all quiet. And you got to be paying attention. And it's time to pick up your step work. And even if you call people, they ain't home, because you got to sit and be still. That's what started happening to me after all that rah-rah. It was my first experiences of following the disease down the wrong road. I did it a lot of other times after that, but that was the first time that I seen it abandon me since I thought I was chasing the truth. And even though it was truth in that, my manipulative self wanted it to be what I wanted it to be, and I was going to make it happen the way that I wanted it to happen, because God couldn't control my life like that. I didn't trust him enough. So I'm always scheming, plotting, and planning the outcome of how things should be. Only until recently, I don't want no control over my life. It's too much. Only recently do I surrender daily, because I don't want no problems out of God. Only recently do I get out of the way so that I can see how he work in others, so I know he's still working in my life. That just started happening to me. I don't want that kind of control. It's too heavy. I had a fortune cookie one time. It said, God's going to give you everything that you want. I was like, no, I don't think so. That's not going to be cool. Because if God gives me everything that I want, I'm going to truly mess it up. It's best if he piecemeal it the way he see fit, so I can respect it, and it'll be things that are earned. And I'll appreciate them. Because if I was given everything, how would I ever need him, seek him, appreciate it, or want him in my life for guidance? I wouldn't even go to him. So I'm grateful that he keep it a little space in the middle where I'm sometimes in confusion, sometimes struggling, sometimes lost, sometimes don't know what direction to turn. Because if I had everything all packed tight, I wouldn't need God. And I'm just that self-centered. Soon as I think I'm doing something on my own, I kind of ease God out of the picture. That's how I used to live, but the price of behaving like that costs too much today. So I don't fool with him like that. I try to check in regularly to make sure I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And even if it's the most scariest thing that I got to do, I still got to run it by him. I still got to run it by him. I can't be not running nothing by God. Because I pay for that. That's personal to me. So even if I don't know how he going to do it, I still got to show it to him some kind of way. To see if this is okay today for me to do. And sometimes that don't feel so good because that's a road that you walk alone. Nobody really gets to walk with you in that. This is between you and the Creator. So sometimes my walks in this process have been alone. Or let's just say I've been walking with God. So, you know, I wasn't really alone in that sense, but I needed to have, because there is a difference between solitude and isolation. Sometimes I just needed to be in those spaces. And I wasn't isolating, I was trying to seek and find. So he had to shut things down in order for me to do that. And it was around 9 years clean that so much noise was in my life because I still hadn't trust God with the most important areas of my life, which is my relationships, my money, and my kids. I hadn't really, you know, I had given him some stuff with the boys, you know, that was, but not with the things of my heart and definitely not with my money. So I was battling. So around 9 years clean, I spent the whole year sharing across the country, saying a whole bunch of stuff that I wasn't living up to. Just sound good to articulate it. What a price. And I kept on saying that whole year, like, what? Because I couldn't hear, because my line and my connection was really disconnected. And I kept on trying to get some juice, and I kept on trying to see what he was saying to me, but I had so much noise in my life that I couldn't hear him. So he just let me keep on going on, because will is free. You can do what you want to do around here. You should get to a place around here where you don't want to do what you want to do. Because doing what you want to do got you all of this shit. It's a good day when you don't want to do what you want to do. And you want to do what God wants you to do, whether you like it or not. Because liking it ain't the point. But it will be the best thing for you. So, you know, I'm sharing up and down the coast and doing all this. And can't even stand myself. I'm going to just share this, right? Because, you know, I'm such a cartoon junkie. And I see every Fred Flintstone, and 'cause one time when I was coming out, divorcing, and didn't have my children, I had every TV in my house had the Cartoon Network on it because I couldn't really get past nothing else. I needed to just kind of stay in fantasy because I just really couldn't get with nothing else. So I looked at, I know all the Fred Flintstones, I know all the Bugs Bunnies, and I'm talking about I have 5 and 6 years clean. And that was my world. And I used to rush home every day to look at fucking cartoons. So one time, Fred, he was all disgusted with himself. So self stepped out. And was like, you don't wanna be with me or whatever? You know, you got a problem with the way that things is going because, you know, he needed to separate. He needed to see himself outside of himself and all the havoc that himself could cause. By the end of that episode of Fred Flintstones, he was begging self to become aligned again. And he started talking stuff and self stepped out and was like, he was like, all right, you know, trying to get in order. That's what happened to me. That's just what happened to me. I had to face myself by myself to see that I didn't want to live with myself anymore. I had enough destruction and despair. I had tired of watching the pain in people's eyes. I was tired of that. Like, manipulating and, you know, just doing the thing that I was doing and, you know, just becoming some notorious boss, you know, just some stuff. And I start seeing the pain in other people. And that hurt me. It really hurt me. To this day, I don't behave that way. To this day. Because I firmly believe until it hurts right. Like, not just hurt. Like, blah. Like, you're going to forget her. Blah. Hurt right. Some lines I will never cross again. And I'm all right with that today. So I spent enough time with myself to see that I didn't like myself. And I really wanted to... something new for myself. I had already been working steps, but the steps happened in order. I hadn't become entirely ready of anything. I was scared to live without the thing that I had always lived with. My father died when I was really young, but me and my brother and sister were manizers. You know, like we manize and manipulate everybody. And I swore that my father had taught us that type of behavior. But he was already dead. And my mother raised me. So I learned how to practice that type of behavior from my mom. You know, just mastered and skillful at manipulation. I didn't like that when I saw that. But my father couldn't have taught me that if he died when I was two. My mother's very skillful. In a loving and caring way. You know what I mean? So were we. My brother and sister is just like that. We're all like that. I'm reformed. I have clean time in that area. I don't behave like that today. I really do. But from time to time, when I feel self-centered fear and I'm starting to get scared, I kind of want to go and revisit. That's why the sixth step is so important. If you do have the pleasure of becoming entirely ready, and God gives you the relief from a defect of character, and you begin to feel the burden of the external behavior or the quieting of the internal thing, you should count your lucky stars, because with enough consistency in that, you might revisit them again. That's what happened to me. I had had some time in not behaving certain ways, and I thought that I had arrived at some place. And I was practicing in principles and all my affairs and this and that and that and this. And then I discovered that they're only arrested. That the reprieve needs to be daily. That whatever work I've done to become entirely ready, because see, I know that God, even though the desire of my heart had changed, I still had to wait in a holding pattern. Like, I didn't want to act like that no more, and I externally wasn't falling short, but the thing was still moving, or the thing on the inside had quailed, but I still was behaving an external way that would say that I was still attached. And I was like, well, God, I'm trying to wait for you. I'm just kind of being here. Can you just kind of do this thing? So one, my ex-partner, I took her over to her future new girlfriend's house, and I didn't know it. And I was sitting in the living room while they was in the room. And I was like, boy, this is really like some out-of-body experience for me. Because I'm not even going to go to jail today. And I didn't even do nothing external. And I was quiet on the inside. Do you know that at that moment, that was the first time that that type of self-centered fear didn't have me hurt somebody, show me that I could grow up and be a woman, teach me how to believe in myself, show me some tangible evidence that God works in my life, And I went on and drove her home. And I was like, I didn't see you. And I was like, wow. This thing really works. It really does. I didn't choke the shit. You know, I was driving. I didn't do none of that. I was like, well, all right. You know, because I understand that sometimes I need to see evidence. Whatever story you in, whatever thing you need to see, sometimes for my faith to continue to grow, God got to give me little shots of who I would be. Just a little something. Just, you know, something for me, you know. Because the desperation of them defects will have you surrender. Don't even worry about it. And your sponsor ain't going to ever help you with that. They're going to say what works for them and how they had to arrive at a place. But the bottom line is that level of desperation, when you see that without the drugs, you the same. You the same. You are the same. I was the same. I was devastated. I have blamed all of who I had become on using drugs. And it was none of it. I had learned it all at home and in school and on the streets. And I had conditioned myself to live a certain kind of way. So that level of desperation let me see that of myself, I don't have what it takes without God in my life to become somebody different that practices spiritual principles in their life. I don't got it. I've got that kind of juice. And I'm all right with knowing that I don't got it. And God is in the right order. And you know, y'all. And I'm somewhere in that equation. This is not an extraordinary person. Just an ordinary process. Something we all have to go through. Just, you know, it's just small. The steps helped me lose my level of self-centeredness and shrunk me down from being extraordinary to ordinary. I just became ordinary Tanya. Goofy, you know, a little slow. Forget, you know, just slow down and just kind of had to meet me in the fear of having to have you guys see me without all of those vices. All of those things that I used to protect myself was the most frightening thing in my life. I didn't care that y'all was talking about me in the meetings, because for a long time I hated y'all. I felt like that was such a cruel thing that y'all done to me. I really did. And I used to come to a meeting at home and a guy used to say, I love this fellowship. And I used to be like, he gonna say that shit again. And I used to be like, I wish he shut up. Because I hated y'all. I felt like y'all wasn't with me. Y'all ain't care. Nobody wanted to ask if I was going to use again. Y'all was only worried about my husband crying. But nobody never asked me that if I did go back home, would I use again? And my children wouldn't have their mother anyway. I had to take the risk. And it wasn't easy, and I walked away from everything that I had. I had to find out if this is what I was supposed to be doing, and I couldn't worry about what y'all was going to think about me. But in turn, I took and internalized that, and I didn't want to mess with y'all. I was like, I don't need them. I got my sponsor, my sponsor sisters, forget y'all. I had become a little hardened from my experiences in here, because sometimes we can be so very unloving. And we don't even really know where people come from. I be careful about that, old timer. Never know nobody where nobody came from. You gotta be careful. You gotta give a person a chance. I was area chair, and I had missed a couple of meetings, and they was about to kick me off the committee and all of that, and you know, do all of this, because I was heavily into service and I've had every position, you know, I helped restructure the policies in the area. I did all of this work, and nobody never asked, was I okay? The reason why I didn't come to the meeting is because I was ashamed or embarrassed. Y'all were talking about me. Y'all were trying to hurt my children through y'all's kids with stuff that they would take to school. Oh, we done that. They done that. And you know, embarrassed my children and stuff. A lot of stuff. A lot of stuff. We was all homophobic, all of us. Me too. You know, just, I am. But not that much today, but I still feel a little ashamed. You know, I do. That's real and that's human. And it's just me. When I started out, I said that the guy on the beach this morning said that our greatest gift that we could give anybody is just being ourselves. That's it. That's all. In my ninth year, when all of this was, you know, I left the marriage. We got divorced when I had 5 years clean. I thought that me allowing him to treat me any kind of way was what I deserved. So I never really just stood up for myself. I was like, well, you know, after all, I did leave him and cheat on him and stuff. It's all right. You got it. 8 and 9 taught me that I had never, ever forgiven myself. And that it was okay if he never, ever forgave me. And that he was my best friend. And I tried to explain to him that I lacked the courage to be able to just tell you the truth. So I went and created all of this stuff so I could beat me home. What? That's what we do. I don't even really know if he's forgiven me, right? But I did my part. 9 freed me. It just did. See, you know, we say 4 was all that, whatever, you know, 5. Then we say, okay, 6, 7, you know, you really got to separate yourself from your 6 self there, you know, all that. But when it's time to write the list, and you take real ownership and what you have done to other people. And my sponsor wanted it in chronological order too. So that meant that my ex-husband was on there quite a few times. And you battle back and forth between somebody forgiving you and you letting, or you know, you forgiving you because God has forgiven you, but it be the other way around, like you want somebody to forgive you first so you can forgive yourself. In the moment, you don't get to get that. Because, see, I had stole everything my mother had at the end of my addiction. I used to help her look for her car when it was in my pocket. She was retiring from a job she had for 25 years, and she took a lump because she was too young. And she had a lump sum of money that she should have been able to live off of for a good while. But me and my sister smoked it all. And my sister's still in active addiction today. And I have a little over 15 and a half years clean. I had to do that with my mom and a couple of other people, but I had to take some real ownership. And I think that my ex-husband was the first person that kind of rejected me from my making amends to him. And I was all right. Well, not like really rejected me, he just said another thing, but it was okay. Like, I had done what I needed to do for myself to be free of it. Because 9 says that free your own self, you'll still get the same freedom even if people don't forgive you because you've done your part in it. 8 and 9 allowed me to experience that everybody that I put on their list, and even if I change my behavior and don't make direct amends to people, that some people will never ever forgive me and always see me the same messed up way. And that goes for intimate and platonic relationships, old lovers and friends and teachers and kids and this and that and that and this. And if I change some of my behavior, it'll clear up some of that stuff. But some of them people you really got to go to. And when I went, and I went to that brother and I said, you know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I really am. And I'm sorry that I just lacked what I lacked at the time. We have a working relationship because we have children to raise. But I'm not quite sure if he's ever going to forgive me, and that's okay. Because some people will never forgive me, and that's okay. Like, I'm going to live with that because the steps said I could. And there's no reflection on my growth. There's no reflection on who I am or where I'm going. There's no reflection on who I've become as a direct result of these spiritual principles. It just is what it is. Because some of our stuff, it just is what it is. Like, it just is what it is. And there's no real science with that. It just is what it is. So, you know, at 10, I start spot checking myself. But what happened was, after that year of everything being all loud in my life, something happened. I had a commitment at home at one of the Swackner conventions. And I was sharing at a topic, and I was talking about an experience that I had with cleaning the floors. And in this meeting, it was me and my partner at the time and another recovering addict. And it was just us. It was one of them early morning meetings. And in our area, it was just like 3 or 4 people in there. And I was sharing about having an experience of cleaning the floor and the thing telling me to stop. And I was like, stop. Well, you know, I kept cleaning the floor, but I thought stop meant about some other stuff. And then it said June. It's like, yeah, all right. This was in March. So I shared about it at the convention. And then June the 11th of 2000, I had a brain aneurysm. And I woke up like 6 weeks after that. And I have been on the road to recovering from that aneurysm ever since then. See, sometimes when God needs your full attention, he'll do what he got to do. And I wasn't listening. I wasn't paying attention. And I had smoked plenty of coke. Trust me. It happened to me. And it would have happened to me because all the stuff that I had done to my body had eventually caught up with me. And it ruptured right in my head. And at the time, somebody was with me. And they got 911, and, you know, they came, and, you know, they got me, and, you know. It's a show that comes on TV, right, on Sunday nights at 9 o'clock, 10 or something like that. And a couple of weeks ago, it was an episode, and he was, you know, in the hospital, and he had an experience while he was unconscious. And he went to the house, and, you know, he was going to go in the house, and he had a briefcase in his hand. And he was like, the guy was like, well, you don't need this. Where you going? They're waiting for you. And he looked around at the house, and it was music and partying was going on and all of that. And he was like, well, you know, I'm coming back. And he was like, no, you're not going to come back. Just leave this here and just go here. And he looked, and he had a glimpse of somebody in the doorway, but he wasn't really sure who that was, but it had reminded him of his mother. And then he started to walk up the steps. And then he woke up. He was in the hospital. See, I understand that when I was unconscious, I had to do a whole negotiating kind of thing with God about my life. And I say, look, come on now, I need a little bit more time here. Who's going to raise the boys, man? You know, the father don't dress them properly and shit. Don't take them to no good barber, the $5 barber, come on. Can you just let me stay a little while longer? I mean that with everything in me. It seemed like I was in some kind of negotiation for my life. And I have been granted more time. It was a gift. Now, you know, when I woke up, that everybody told me that everybody they knew died. And then I start trying to figure out, why was I still alive? You know, I said, okay, well, I didn't die because, you know, I got to take care of the kids or whatever. But that reasoning has changed, and it was 5 years ago. I'm a survivor today. And in that, I didn't want to tell nobody that I was scared to live because I didn't want the same thing to happen to me again. It was such a responsibility on me to still be alive and not know what God's will was for me that I was too ashamed and afraid to tell y'all that it looked like it was a nice place and how come I ain't get to go? I just wanted to try to explain that to y'all. I didn't want y'all to think that I died, but I was feeling some old kind of way because I ain't get to go. If you can understand what I'm saying. Because it seemed like a real nice place to go. Just wasn't time for me to go, I guess. And it was really nice and warm. And I understand that everybody got their own interpretation of what heaven is to them. And it was a nice place. And it don't really got to be explained or whatever, y'all. But I said that thing that I told y'all about that show on TV, because mine was like that too. I was standing in front of a house with a skirt on, so you know it was like not true. I mean, you know. Like I was all linened up and girl, you know, like I was all that, you know, my woman. And I was contemplating going in, but I didn't go. And next thing I know, I woke up, and from what my understanding was, I sat up in the bed and said, boy, y'all, like a breath of fresh air. Everybody in the room bust out crying. It had been like 32 days. And of course, I had to learn everything all over again. And walk with a cane and my stitches and, you know, my hair, because, you know, my hair got cut off, you know, just all of that stuff. And then I didn't want to tell y'all I was afraid to live and like what God gonna do to me. Then I didn't want to tell y'all that I wanted to die, like I thought that that was what that really was, that I really wanted to die, and how angry I was when I started going to funerals and people was crying and all that on the floor and all that. And I was like, hey, check this out, don't be crying. Cause know that they got nice, this nice where they at. Don't worry about them. You gotta learn how to live your life right here now so you can be prepared for that. Don't be crying about them. Cry and joy for them. Cause if, you know, I just feel like I've gotten the opportunity to experience that and just tell y'all about it. That's it. But it just really wasn't my time, and I really battled deeply with that in my spirit. So as a direct result of me going through those different stages from depression and rehab and learning how, you know, because I had a cognitive aneurysm, so I had to learn all of this stuff all over again and do this, excuse me, and do that and learn how to walk again and remember stuff, and I tie everything to something so I can remember. Like, if I'm supposed to call somebody back, I say, I'm going to call them back when I leave. So if I don't leave for the next hour, I don't call them back because I stay in the house. I call them back when I leave. Not, I'm in the house and I ain't leave when I said I was going to leave. I'm going to call them when I walk out the door. So when I walk out the door, I'm going to remember that I'm supposed to call them. And that's how I remember stuff. I tie stuff to stuff. And if I don't do the thing till I do it, then I don't do what I'm supposed to do until I do it, because I tie stuff to stuff. I just realized that that's my form of working my memory. And on some days, I'm still lost, and on some days, I need all of y'all help. And for a person that never really wanted nobody to help them, God took everything from me and had to have me in a place for everybody to help me. I needed to see what it really was like. So I had to go from one stage to another, from helping everybody, not letting nobody help me, to having everybody help me. Humbly. I can't get up the steps. I can't do this. I forgot this. I don't remember this. I don't remember that. I don't know how to count my money. Can you show me how to work this? I don't know how to use this. Feeling the shame and embarrassment from that. Never really want nobody to see that about me. Because I still look the same. Just that my mind don't work the way it used to. As a direct result of that, I was in the middle of graduate school when I had the aneurysm. I just graduated in December. They just passed. The school let me come back in 02 because they start waving all of this stuff in front of me like money and degree and this and that. I'm talking about a master's degree. And they say, come on back, we're going to give you this, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And I was like, yeah, I'll come on back, but I wasn't ready. So I failed. Then I had to come back in 03 for seat time. Then I had to come back again for more seat time, and then I lost the candidacy because you only get 5 years to do it. So I had to call somebody up at the main campus and petition to have the candidacy open back up. And in January of 05, I went back to graduate school, and I finished in December of 05. And I walked, and it took 7 years to get it, but I've done that with the help of you guys and God. Let me just say this, and I'm going to shut it down, because do y'all know that people in the world want to know how we do this? The world is looking towards the people in recovery on the how-to experience. We've become experts right in here. Because people want to put words to our wordless language out there. So they watching us, and they want in institutions and places, if anybody in here is a clinician like me, they want us to show them how we do it. They're putting words to our wordless language, and they're articulating it in a way that people can read it, and it is the how-to out there. That's what they're doing. They're fascinated how so many of us, I'm telling y'all, I work right in the mainstream of a thing that's happening, and my ideas and opinions have been sought out by professionals. They want to know what we think would work for the many suffering people out there. Please, if you out there in the field, I don't associate myself with Narcotics Anonymous. I just, you know, like, but I am a recovering person in those arenas. And I've allowed that much of my anonymity to be broken as a vehicle for some kind of help. Just simply, I'm very well educated in what we do in here, and I would never, ever violate that, but they need us to retrieve some of these suffering addicts. They need us to show them what our wordless language is about. And they're coming to us for that expertise. If you have an opportunity to make yourself available for that, with the respect of where you've come from, by all means, share the information, because each one does teach one, and the whole world is watching our experiences, y'all. I'm telling you, it's like some kind of revolution. Seriously, they want to know how we've done this. And they want to put words to what we do. Now, of course, you know that it is an intuitive process, and it will not be able to adequately be explained by words. That is nothing that we can give them in a bottle. So, therefore, they're looking for us to lead this movement. So, if you aren't in school, get in school. If you feel like you want to be in some other kind of service, do that, because they're going to come for us. They're tired. It is a $1 billion industry, and they're losing. and we do this in here, and we're fully self-supporting, we don't take any outside contributions from them, and they're baffled by us. I feel a little bit sad for them, because what we do can't be articulated like that. It's a lead program. It is a guidance thing. It is how we move from A to B. It is not something that we can put on paper. And trust me, they're trying to put it on paper, because that's what that world is used to doing. They're not used to the wordless language of empathy and each one feel and teach. And, you know, the thing that connects us and ties us together. They don't understand that. They don't understand how somebody can be in a chronic condition in 3 to 4 years, retrieve some of the things that they've lost back in their life. They want to know how we've done that and write it out on a piece of paper. Seriously, that's what they want us to do. Write it out so we can make money off of it. Did I say that? All right, I meant that too. That's what they really want to be able to do, to package and bottle and label what God has given us so freely to give to the next person. Imagine that. There really has to be some kind of way that we share and care with that population. Not just because we want some type of recognition or compensation, but that it is what has been so freely given to us. I would be nothing without you guys. Everything about my woman was taught to me by another woman out there. Being a mom, being a friend, being, you know, with somebody to be with me in a relationship, being a worker, all of that stuff. I had none of those skills, or they were so underdeveloped that I needed somebody to teach me how to do that. And I didn't even have to pay nobody. So how would they expect to charge for God's gift and package it like it was for sale? I don't know. It's baffling, and I'm still torn, and I don't know how far I'll go with this with them. But I want to be obedient. And I keep asking, like, we in these arenas and you cleaned us up. And some of us got to go to certain places to do certain things. And how do we do that and preserve what we do without compromising our gift? I'm going to leave that to y'all. I know that because of the way the world is evolving, our whole structure will be presented an opportunity one day from the world on down. And somebody's going to table this somewhere, because somebody out there needs to know how we do this. And whoever is in charge of this, talking about God, will help us marry this off and unpack this for the next suffering addict. Thanks for letting me share.